on Judgment Day before the gods, these will be my words, my statement. I am a servant of Indians. India belongs to me. Indian is my blood and my caste. This is my only religion, my only tribe, my only clan. Oh, Mother India, this is not to be my fate, my good fortune that with every movement of mine I could have worshipped your feet. Oh, Mother India, if my head is offered, if my life is sacrificed in your service, then I would understand that even in my death, I will attain a life of eternity.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of American Desis. I am Arjun.
I'm Akash.
And today we are outside. We are at the University of California, Berkeley, otherwise known as Cal. We are outside because we have just gotten a chance to be on a walking tour. It's the South Asian Radical Walking History Tour. Somewhere history is in there because they're talking about history, about South Asians and their activism. And it's in honor of that, we thought we would do this little episode outside. I'm saying in honor of it, but reality, everywhere on this campus, this is closed. So we're sitting outside. If you hear people standing outside yelling at us,
it's because we're racist. No, I'm kidding. It was a fire alarm. Things are kind of chaotic. Arjun can't remember the exact name of the tour. So why don't we let the guests tell you?
But, yeah, that's a good time to introduce, I guess. We have today, we have Anirvan Chatterjee.
Yeah.
And we have Barnali Ghosh.
Hey there.
Now, you guys have been doing this tour, as you guys said, 5 years now?
Four years.
Mm-hmm. I added a year because it was just so good. They gave us a little bit of an excerpt. They got to talk to us about two stories, which we will be telling you guys. We got to record it, and so hopefully we'll be able to put it into this episode so you guys can enjoy it as well and understand the context. But you said that you love doing this tour because afterwards there are always discussions. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. We do the Berkeley South Asian Radical History Walking Tour, and it's a long name, really because we want to start changing the conversation about what our community thinks of as what our history is, what we do with it, the kind of activism we do, just for people to even know that we do activism. And history out of textbooks is fine, but if it doesn't actually like change anything, I don't think it's very useful.
When did you guys come up with the idea for the Berkeley South Asian American Radical Walking Tour. History Tour? History Walking Tour.
It should just roll off your tongue. Berkeley, South Asian Radical History Walking Tour. But it rolls off our tongue because of how many times we've done it. Well, we've been thinking about it, I guess, for a little bit.
Real quick backstory. You guys are married. You have been married for 12 years. And together for 14 now, right?
Yeah. Okay. Almost 14 years. Yeah. We've been together a long time. So we actually refer to the walking tour as our child, though it took less than 9 months to, I guess, put it together, though we've been thinking about it for longer than that.
When did each of you, or did it come together, did it come from both of you together, this passion of history and this passion of spreading that history? Was, you know, is it something you had always known, something you had grown up with, or something that you came to understand?
So for me, I grew up in the Bay Area, I grew up in the East Bay, and I had uncles in my community who would tell me about South Asian histories from the early 1900s. So I always kind of grew up knowing that there was like something interesting that happened back there, but it didn't really kind of connect for me. And then I moved to Berkeley as an undergrad, and that's fine. I mean, Berkeley is kind of mythology about itself, is that it's all about like primarily white folks in the 1960s doing free speech movement, doing all that stuff. And that's cool, and I'm really excited about that. But it wasn't until much later, after I left UC Berkeley, after I became a townie, just kind of living and working in the city of Berkeley, that I started meeting a lot of these older Desi activists in the community. And they're just, you know, just really normal, modest people. And then I'd run into them, I'd talk to them, and they'd just be like, they'd just like spit out some kind of a story about something that they did, or they'd mention it. And it would just make my jaw drop. And there's just something about like, hearing the stories of these people who might be like elders or uncles. And like, it just kind of gave me the sense of like, there's all this stuff there that I didn't know about.
Banali, I'm going to jump to you in a second, but I want to ask you. So you grew up here in this country and you were not aware of this history.
Not at all. I mean, after we started learning these histories, I remember being frustrated and going up to my parents and going like, why didn't you tell me any of this? And they look at me and they're like, well, nobody gives you a book of history when you get off a plane. I mean, they didn't know any more South Asian American history than I did.
Oh, they don't know either.
Yeah, I mean, not really. I mean, you know, my dad was an engineer. He walked off a plane and, you know, I mean, he saw the community around him, but he didn't know that we had like radical histories and activist histories.
So what did it do to you or your sense of identity once you started to realize that, once you learned this history? I mean, did you feel something different? Can you specify a shift for yourself?
Yeah, I totally changed after learning these stories. I mean, for me, there's something about, I mean, I knew that we are hardworking people. I knew that we are engineers and hotel workers and, you know, just all, and cab drivers and all that. What I didn't know is that we are badass feminists. We are anti-colonial warriors. That we have like built alliances between different communities at times of crisis. None of that stuff is stuff that I knew or my parents actually knew. And learning these stories, especially here in the city that I live in, the city of Berkeley, it changes the way that I walk these streets. Just knowing that there are people who look like me, people who speak my language, people who have been here for a century, and you know that it's. That's something that I can, and I've been working for justice, and that's something that I can like think about, that I can work toward as well, because that's actually part of my tradition. It's not just the food and the music and all that.
We're going to put a pin in the communities and the alliances. We're going to come back to that in a little bit, but I would love to hear from you, Bernali, about your experience knowing this history and a key difference that you came to this country. You weren't born here.
Right. So I came to study at UC Berkeley to do my master's in landscape architecture. And when I had a little bit of choice in what place to pick to go to. And I had heard echoes of the free speech movement and things like that, even while I was growing up in Bangalore in India. And there was definitely an attraction and a pull there to move to the city. However, when I moved here, I wasn't very politicized, so it's not like I was doing any kind of social activism back home. And I moved here when I was 25.
Can I put a pause in this for a second? Now, you were coming here for landscape architecture.
Correct.
Which is wildly different than any sort of activism, political or anything.
Correct.
When you were growing up, were you aligned with certain political ideas? Was that just something in you that you had to bury? Can you talk about that?
I didn't really think about it that much. I think when you're growing up in India, for somebody like me, like my parents were pretty educated and privileged, put a lot of emphasis on education, you know, but I guess rocking the boat wasn't part of that necessarily. But I always felt like there was something in me that did want to rock the boat a little bit. Also part of the reason I didn't do engineering or medicine, that I had the ability to choose a more creative field like architecture or landscape architecture.
So here's something we've been hearing recently is that in India, there's a certain romanticism with activism. And we talked to somebody a couple days ago who said like, His grandfather got locked up for protesting the British, and there was this like really this legend grew with it. Did your family not have any of that, or was that not really there when you were growing up?
I mean, we talked about issues. We talked about you know, what was just and what was unjust. We definitely had political leanings that were more, I guess, left leaning, you could say. But we were, I think if you're from a middle class family, it's not very often that you're out on the streets protesting. And as far as I know, my family wasn't necessarily part of the independence movement or things like that. Though I will definitely say being Bengali, there is a certain pride in a lot of amazing independence movements coming out of Calcutta, coming out of that region. So there was that. But so when I moved here and I wanted to be more engaged, one of the first things I did was actually join an organization called ASHA for Education.
So
and
like, as soon as you got here, you knew this is what you
No, as soon as I got here, I was overwhelmed with school.
Okay.
As a woman, there are some parts that, you know, growing up as a woman in India definitely means that even if you don't want to be an activist, you are always sort of fighting a certain kind of gender inequality. Mm-hmm. So I will say very frankly that what I was doing was running away from home so as to not pressure to be married or settle down or any of that. Right. So when I moved here, I was looking for an escape from my South Asian identity. Huh. So I wasn't really looking to meet other people who are like me or who are from India or any of that.
Is there a big South Asian population at Berkeley?
There is a very big South Asian population. Yeah.
But how many of them are really doing landscape architecture, right?
Like, not that many.
Yeah, I don't even know what that
not
is.
Not that many. But, you know, it's a big campus. So you ran into people and you would see another desi and neither of us would smile at each other, for instance.
Really? Yeah, I was going to ask, like, how much of the South Asian community here is unified? How much of them care that they're South Asian, how much of that, and how many of them maybe are coming to also do that to escape their South Asian identity?
I think, you know, I can't speak for everybody, obviously.
I'll speak for everybody. Come on, let's do that. Let's do that on the podcast.
That's what I do, is I speak
for everybody. But the story I was going to tell you is why I joined this organization, ASHA for Education, right? So at some point, 2 years into being here, I decided that I didn't want to cut myself off from my homeland. I wanted to be engaged in some way, but I didn't want to be engaged in the typical ways of Bollywood or food.
I'm sorry, real quick, was there something in particular that made you want to reconnect, or was it just like...
I was just homesick.
Okay.
I was homesick, but I was still resistant to just being connected through Bollywood and or okay. film and food, right? So I was looking for a meaningful connection
fulfilling.
Back home. And this organization gave me that because we were raising money here to support schools in India. It felt good to do that. You met other people who shared similar values about inequity, who were all interested in contributing back home. The fact that at that point, and I was with the organization for almost 7 years, it was a very non-hierarchical organization, so I could do a lot, you know, and bring a lot of ideas to it. But the fact that you could raise $300 here and you could support a teacher in India for a whole year was very motivating. But the story I tell even on the tour is all of that still feels within my comfort zone. And the first time I felt sort of compelled to step outside of that comfort zone was when the war against Iraq broke out. The war against Afghanistan broke out in 2001. And San Francisco has a huge anti-war movement. And I would hear all these stories of people marching, thousands of people marching on the streets of San Francisco, protesting the war. And I think that's when it sort of clicked for me that that's where my values were, and that's the movement I wanted to be part of, and that's where I wanted to push myself outside of my comfort zone to put myself on the street and be able to yell out a slogan, because for a middle-class woman like me, that wasn't necessarily normal in the way I grew up.
So when started the search for the history of South Asians in this country? When did that start for you? What was that journey?
I think for the history part, it was mostly because Anirban and I would talk a lot about it. And that also the fact that both of us came from doing organizing and activism in our communities and hearing these stories.
So let me ask you, what was your perception of the South Asian American history here?
You know, actually, there was this very specific moment in the Bancroft Library that's just up the road where I saw an exhibit of Punjabi Mexicans who were here in California from the early, I guess, 1900s to later. And when I saw that, I think that really broke all the stereotypes I had of when we got here. And my understanding of when we got here was that there was this huge migration that happened in the 60s.
You also held that idea that it was
absolutely.
The 60s.
So absolutely.
When it shifted, so let's, for a quick second, for our listeners, and I'm going to let you guys do this very, but just like highlights, we got here as a community when? Around when? Try as best
as you
California,
can. Well, California, we think it's 1850, but in the U.S. it's much older than that.
I mean, some of the oldest South Asian histories we find in the U.S. go all the way back to 1600s, early Virginia, you know, just before the United States became the United States. There were South Asian slaves.
So the other Indians and us Indians were both here before?
A lot more of them, but yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
Not before white people.
Yeah, after white
the white people,
people
brought
before
us
America.
Here.
America.
Yeah. Well,
before the United States of America. We're not going to do that.
Pre-1776.
You know what I mean? What are we parsing words for?
I'm not parsing. Okay. So, yes. But then 1850s in California, but 1900s is early 1900s is when I heard you get a lot of stuff. That's when we started to have more.
1890 was when those migrations started. So 1890, early 1900s in California.
And I'm going to very much be reductive. So, and then the early parts of the 1900 was a big part of the Asian exclusion sort of
right.
Mentality.
Yes.
Can you speak again to that a little bit? I know I'm asking you guys mm-hmm. to try to
condense a 3-hour tour into 30 seconds. Go.
Go.
It's more like 300 years into 30 seconds.
Right. Go for it.
So, there have been South Asians in the United States since at least the 1600s. Immigration in kind of an interesting, meaningful way, I'd say, really kind of picked up in the late 1800s, early 1900s. By the 1900s, 1910s, the Desis were coming here. Some of them were coming directly from India. Some of them were getting pushed out of places like Canada and coming south. Mm-hmm. So by the time they're in California, a lot of them are farmers. A lot of them are laborers, sometimes working in things like sawmills, mm-hmm. sometimes like the Chinese helping build the railroads. Now, this is a time when there's a lot of anti-Asian sentiment in general. Most of that was directed against Chinese, Japanese, but we got a little bit of that too. So a lot of the laws that really were attacking all Asian immigration, like, absolutely impacted us. And
we didn't just get a little bit of it. There was an entire law for...
It started out being the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was very much directed towards the Chinese immigration initially. And then as it became more inclusive of all Asians, it became the Asian Exclusion Act.
So, yay, Asian solidarity. Like, they started pulling us in and, you know, really, like, putting us all together. Yeah, I mean, there are definitely, like, large communities of South Asians that were attacked in many cases, just big race riots. But even here in, like, the little city of Berkeley, California, which has, like, roughly 100,000 people, I mean, we look back at old newspapers and, you know, we find stories of police having, like, really, like, brutal racist tactics to, like, clamp down on South Asians living in West Berkeley. Mm-hmm. We have stories of really early Desi families who would, like, buy a house in the city of Berkeley, but then move here and then not be able to, like, move in because all the neighbors, mm-hmm. like, locked the doors and, mm-hmm. like, just were doing stuff. So they were, like, forced out of the city. I mean, now when you walk around Berkeley, you know, it's a college town, you know, you see lots of South Asian faces, but that early history of exclusion and racist attacks, mm-hmm. it kind of gets lost a little bit.
Well, the reason that I wanted to talk about that, and then now I'm going to unpin the communities and the alliances that you wanted to that you were talking about. With what's happening now with police brutality for our black brothers and sisters in this country today, there's been a movement amongst a lot of people to ignore, and there's been a lot of conversation, a lot of people in the South Asian community is not getting involved. Mm-hmm. Hearing history like this to me becomes so important to know that, whoa, this was us. We were also a part of that. This is also our fight. Did that shift for you also when you started learning about that history? Did that start to become Bernali, whoever wants to speak?
So I'm going to talk about one specific moment.
Get it.
And then Anirvan
can
talk about...
We like specificity on this podcast.
Anirvan's really the history geek in this. I'm more about, owning the city and taking the city back for myself. I'll come back to that later.
Yeah.
But for me, when we think about our relationship with what's happening with black communities today, it actually goes beyond just the fact that we face similar racism because black people were brought here as slaves and many of us came here as immigrants. So there is a difference.
Absolutely.
And I think it's important to note that difference. However, when it comes to thinking about that history, and y'all mentioned 1965, the Immigration Act changing that brought a certain class of people here. But what we don't talk about is how did 1965 happen? What else was going on around that time? And it was the civil rights movement. And it was the civil rights movement that led to all of these racist laws being changed that actually changed the immigration law and opened up the doors for us to come here in larger numbers.
So before 1965, there were just really ridiculous laws in place where, like, in some cases, only 100 people from India could immigrate to the United States every year. 1965, the laws changed and the floodgates opened.
And when I think about that moment and I think about how that happened and I think about the civil rights movement, I see South Asians being here as a result of the civil rights movement. So I think as South Asians, we owe a huge debt to actually the activists who fought for civil rights, because without their blood and sweat and tears, we wouldn't even be here, even the community that is here.
So the Civil Rights Movement had a whole bunch of different really kind of major victories, things like the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act. But the Immigration Act of 1965 was one of those really key major four or five victories, legislative victories of the Civil Rights Movement. And it's something that a lot of Civil Rights Movement leaders absolutely did and should take credit for. And so basically you have black bodies getting brutalized by the police. You have black activists who are fighting to overturn so many of the United States' most racist laws. And that includes these really racist immigration laws as well. So when we look at that moment, we're like, there are black bodies that actually helped open the floodgates for us to even like be in this country in a meaningful way. I mean, yes, some of us were here earlier than that, but they clamped down on that. And the real immigration began after black activists fought for the laws that made it possible. So in some ways, we really look at this and we kind of figure that black activism helped create South Asian America as we know it today.
So if the way we want to be engaged in this movement is also to think of it as a debt that we're paying back. So it's not just a shared struggle, but more so it's a debt that we owe to black activists who put their lives on the line so people like us could be here.
But it was stunning to hear in the tour. I will briefly summarize. The two story you told us two stories of in 1999, 2000. Y'all can correct me vocally. It's not uncommon that happens on this podcast. You told us a story of 1999, 2000, a South Asian feminist vigil and an intersectional feminist movement to support workers and kind of in response to labor trafficking and sex trafficking that was happening by a prominent South Asian family business owner here in town, and then also about Kirtana Singh Saraba?
Kirtar Singh Saraba of the Gadar Party.
I mean, I'm glad you're off mic for that. I'm going to let one of you guys... He came here to be a student and ended up becoming a part of the Gadar Party and becoming a prominent member of the fight for India's independence movement. In both of those stories, there was a lot of collaboration with other communities, and I was hoping you guys could speak to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of these things where we have the sense sometimes that it's all about like merit. It's all about us pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps because we're like good people and we should be able to kind of do everything kind of by ourselves. But the thing that we've learned as we've researched the stories that we tell on the Berkeley South Asian Radical History Walking Tour is that again and again and again, we have had incredible allies. We've had incredible support from folks in other communities. I mean, that could include things like, say, in the case of the South Asian feminists who organized against Lucky Reddy, Bali Reddy, and the Reddy family, who were these rich Berkeley sex and labor traffickers. They were getting support from other Asian American communities, from other feminist communities. They were getting support from just all these like really different parts of the community that started stepping up. But their leadership as South Asian feminists was actually really key to help kind of really help direct and channel that energy. But this is actually a much larger story. I mean, when we look, say, at the story of the Gadar Party, and they were the folks who were here on the West Coast and around the world in the 1910s onward, fighting for India's independence. Thousands of primarily Punjabi, primarily Sikh, and others living on the West Coast, and then heading back to India in the mid-1910s to like try to overthrow the British with guns from the United States, because you know you come to the U.S. to get guns. Why else?
Well,
would you?
And Germany.
But. Yes, yeah. So they would, they were here and they were hanging out and working and getting support from Irish Americans, for example. I mean, when I think about Indians and Irish, I'm like, I don't know. I mean, like, I don't see a lot of connection normally, but like...
I compare Irish people to Punjabis because they're pale skinned, they drink a lot, and they love to fight.
Yes, I couldn't have said that. But I mean, it's
I'll say it.
Thank you. There's something that's just this like amazing moment in the 1910s when all these Desi revolutionaries show up in the United States, and they're here because, you know, they got to get out of the empire. Like you go to some place like the UK, I mean, you're surveilled, you're part of the empire, and it's, you know, 1911, 1912, 1913, you're safe in the United States because the U.S. fought British colonization, and that's what they wanted as well. So they're here, and they like look around, and they start meeting like socialists and anarchists and all these other folks here in the United States, but also all these Irish communities. And the Irish and the Indians, they start plotting together because the only way they're ever going to defeat empire is by working together. So in like Urdu and Gaelic, you know, and like all their languages, I mean, they're plotting that revolution. And that becomes very real when Irish Americans start like helping some of the Indian revolutionaries get weaponry, get access to guns. They're sharing tactics. They're sharing political strategies. There are these like publications like the Gaelic American that's like regularly writing about like the Indian revolutionary movement. I mean, it's kind of amazing for us when we actually see what that looked like, and that has continued. I mean, some of the descendants of the Gadar Party, they talk about what it was like for them in the 50s, 60s, 70s to be doing stuff in support of Cesar Chavez's movement, standing up in support of the Black Panthers. Just the idea that like somebody like this, Carter Dillon, who was a member of the Gadar Party, that early in her life, much later in her life, she would be like standing up to defend the Panthers in Oakland when the police, when the OPD, the Oakland Police Department, were coming to like arrest the Panthers. This like little old Punjabi lady from the Gadar Party was standing there between the cops on one side ahead of her and the Panthers behind her. And, you know, they're going to have to, like, go through her to get to the Panthers. I mean, there's this, like, amazing, beautiful revolutionary spirit that, like, cuts across so many of our stories. And that is about those kind of moments of connection over and over and over again.
Well, that's the thing that it really does cut across the narrative of what we think of as the South Asian American experience and what it means to be South Asian. I mean, knowing our roots is such an important part of, like, what we think about in general with our identity. And knowing that our roots is... You know, the roots of revolutionary in India is very like clearly talked about, but understanding that was existed here, I mean, it cuts. I mean, part of what excites me is that it cuts directly at this model minority myth. I mean, that's. Before I move on, when you found out your specific moment of understanding, like the shift in you changed your perception about South Asian American history here, did that affect your new forming identity, or?
I think being an immigrant and, you know, being a recent immigrant or some first generation immigrant, I always sort of questioned where home was. So never quite feeling comfortable here in the U.S. or back home in India, right? Always sort of feeling torn and wondering if I was going to move back or, you know, what was going to happen with that. But I think Kartar Singh Saraba's story and the story of the Gadar Party really, really moved me because I was like, we were here, you know, over 100 years ago. And we weren't just here. We were doing things that really match my values today, that we were fighting for equity and justice. And that empowers me so much to walk the streets of Berkeley in a completely different way. Like, you think you have a right to be here? Hello, I have a right to be here too. And I have a right to like raise my voice. So I think just knowing that story finally made Berkeley feel like home for me and really sort of grounded me here and made me feel a sense of belonging.
Well, I have a question. So you guys have been doing this tour for 4 years, and you are actually currently booked. You were booked through all of May and booked through all of June now. So you're doing very well. What is the biggest shift you see within people from beginning of the tour to the end of the tour? I knew I had a good question. I knew it.
So you know that when we start the tour, we let people know that we're going to be sharing a collection of 6 stories out of all of the stories that we have. And there's many, many stories of South Asian activism in Berkeley. And we ask people to share their favorite moment or their favorite story from what they've heard. And I think that really allows us to understand the shift that we see in people. Most of it... Definitely, you know, some of what y'all are feeling like, oh my God, we didn't know we've been here for so long. Oh my God, there were freedom fighters who were walking on the streets. Oh my God, we have traffickers in our community. There's a lot of, I think, shock and sadness in recognizing that. We see a lot of our organizer friends bringing their families, and we see a shift there where, you know, a lot of times people who do organizing work, they're one person when they go to a family wedding, they're a different person when they go to work. And
more sober at work? Is that the big difference?
Well,
much,
you know,
less drunk.
You never know what organizers do after work, how they have to deal with the pain. So we've you know, when they bring their parents or their brothers and sisters who they've had a hard time explaining what to do, we see that it opens up that place for discussion with folks that came, because we're doing the hard part of putting out and explaining what these folks do on a day-to-day basis.
Do people ever come back to you and say, like, this created this change within my family dynamic or me?
Yeah, it made it easier for them to have some conversations with their families over dinner, you know, to talk about, like, Black Lives Matter stuff. Well, we're not the only ones doing this work, but definitely at the end of the tour, you see that. You see a lot of, we had one person who, it was the first time they came out publicly in front of a South Asian group, you know. So somebody who is gay, but has never said that vocally in a group of strangers. That was the first time they felt comfortable.
Oh, on this tour? Say,
on the tour. Wow. I mean, it wasn't their first time, but it was the first time that they would have said openly, that in a group of strangers, yeah, that were Desi.
Well, to create that kind of safety in a space is, mm-hmm, pretty remarkable. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just, I mean, we talk about, I mean, I mainly talk about it, but we both care very deeply about creating space. I mean, that's why we started this, and creating safe spaces. And, you know, we can't do this without safe, mm-hmm, space, but it can be really difficult. And so that's a remarkable achievement to
and
be able to
I
do
I think
so.
One of the most powerful moments is also, we didn't perform the last story for you today, but the last story is about Berkeley High high school students organizing post 9/11 because of the hate that they were facing in their school. Before we start that story, we will often ask people, we read a list of incidents that happened right here in California, in Berkeley, in Oakland, in places that you don't expect hate crimes like this to happen. We have people read those accounts, and then we ask people how that made them feel. At that moment, we've had many people share, again, for the first time, their experience facing racism, facing hate after 9/11. Again, something they've not had an opportunity to share with somebody else. And sometimes for partners who may not be Desi, for audience members who may not be Desi, it's the first time they've actually heard in person somebody explain to them that this is a real thing. It isn't something that's just made up. It's something you read in the newspaper, that even in the small audience, there's at least two or three stories of having faced that intense kind of racism, especially after 9/11.
And so one of the things we're definitely trying to do is change the conversation, but we also have a not-so-secret agenda of wanting to, like, get people doing different kinds of activism. And, you know, we don't really necessarily care, like, what specifically that is, but I think the big thing here is that, I mean, the way that people talk about, like, Desiness or South Asian culture, it's all about being that perfect model minority. And our goal is to really, like, break down a whole bunch of different stories across 100 years, even in, like, just this little city of Berkeley, California. And stories like this exist everywhere in the United States. We just happen to live here, which is why we tell Berkeley stories. But for people to be able to hear those stories and hear them broken down so they kind of understand what sort of the different pieces are, how people have actually done that activism, some of the challenges that they've had, some of the nuances that they've had to kind of work through, just so they can, like, imagine themselves doing that. We are more than engineers. We are more than, like, accountants. We are more than motel owners. I mean, like, that's part of our history. That's really important. But for so many people whose stories we tell on the tour, they are that and more. Mm-hmm. And we want people to be able to, like, visualize people who look like them doing that. And that, you know, whether that means speaking out against a homophobic joke, whether that's, like, fighting for climate justice. You know, there's so many different ways we can all engage. But we need to know that people like us have done that, so people we can, like, step into that tradition and not just think of that as, like, oh, well, other people do that, not us.
I'm not sure if you've answered this, but I thought this would be a question to close with as we're running out of time. History is most important to learn from so that we cannot repeat its mistakes, so that we can go forward in a new and ideally better way. What is this history that you share? What would you like it to teach us going forward? And us as the generic us. What do you take away from this history as the lesson for our present and future?
Whew.
I'm telling you guys, I don't know if it's the cold or whether it's like, yo, this was my dream school. I don't know, but it's feeding me right now because I'm on my game right now. Let's go.
Sir,
answer that.
Your question was, what do we want people to take away from learning this history?
Sure, yeah.
Right?
Or what do you take away? What is the lesson here? What or one of the lessons here
well,
for
I'll,
our present
I'll speak
and future?
In one specific instance, and you can, Anirvan can speak more generally, I think. I think for both of us, a big motivation in the last, I guess, 5 or 6 years has been around climate change. And we see the role of South Asians in the U.S. having a very specific role and responsibility when it comes to climate change. We think of it as a new empire, in a sense, because of how very developed countries, you know, like the U.K., like the U.S., have contributed to the problem, yet the people who are going to face its worst impacts are people back in our homelands, people in South Asia. So what is our role and responsibility as South Asian Americans living in the U.S.? The fact that we live in a country that is still, you know, one of the major contributors to climate change, historically has been a major contributor to climate change. We participate in that economy, and yet it's our own people, our families, our friends, our traditions, our food, all of that is being impacted. So that's why I think the Gadhar Party story has that impact on me, where climate change is often seen as this huge problem that where do we start? How do we begin? How do we even begin to take it on? You know, it's in so many countries in so many ways. It's a global problem and it's very similar to empire. So when I see this seemingly ragtag, you know, group of people living in a foreign country and having the guts to take down empire, that really inspires me.
So what I'm hearing from you, it's a lesson of empowerment and responsibility.
Empowerment and responsibility, and no, even if a problem seems big and insurmountable, like climate change, it was like empire, and people did not shirk from pushing back against it with all their might.
So Bernelli talked about really big problems and some of the really oldest stories that we tell on the tour. For me, what I really connect to is some of the newest stories, some of the more recent stories, things that happened in the 80s, 90s, even the 2000s. And when we tell stories of feminists and queer folks and environmentalists, I mean, the thing that I really look at that and I see these people who are in some cases still like walking around the Bay Area today. They're still continuing to do that work. And I could really like visualize these people and their stories and how they got to be doing the stuff that they're doing, because they look a lot like me and they talk a lot like me. And I really kind of want folks to like walk away with the idea that you can be doing exactly what you're doing. You can be exactly who you are. And just like these folks of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Man, this sounds like a radio station. You can like step into this role as somebody who is an activist, somebody who does work for justice. Because if Tinku Ali Ishtiak, one of the early members of Trikon who lived in Berkeley, could like work for Palestine and work for queer visibility in the South Asian community, and if he could work for Bangladesh while being a software engineer, maybe you and I can too. Or you know, just like we can be doing all our stereotypical stuff and still like be working for justice, because it's not that hard and we have always been doing it.
I got nothing to close on that. That's beautiful.
How can people connect with you? How can people go on the walking tours? Is there any way you want to reach out to people? Arjun really froze up there.
I was processing.
Yeah, you can find out more on our website. That's berkeleysouthasian.org. We're on Facebook, or you can hit me up on Twitter at A-N-I-R-V-A-N.
And we do the tours monthly. So we have one day a month that we do two tours on. And if you're coming into town and you want us to do a tour and you can get a group together, we're happy to do that as well.
And that can all be found on that same website, berkeleysouthasian.org. They are nodding in the affirmative. At that moment, I will just relay that information. Bad cop.
Guys, thank you for being a part of this podcast. We appreciate it. You said some really wonderful things. Listeners, we hope you enjoyed it. Now, if you can do us a favor and get off your stupid ass and rate the podcast 5 stars. Oh, real quick, shout out to user Nish Poppy. The best review we've gotten is just the flame emoji, the hands prayer emoji, and then the 100 emoji. Let me just get that again.
Damn.
From everyone. You are a hero. Everyone else, 5 stars. Stop wasting time.
I'm going to swoop in and just tell you, remind you guys that we actually do deeply care about each and every one of you. He's it's a defense mechanism, guys, because he has so
not
much.
A defense mechanism.
Stop it.
I'm tired of you.
Well, I'm going to say this, that we are trying to build community. We are, look, we want to create space so that we can keep telling these stories. And, you know, a guy walking down the street with no sheep behind him. I don't know what that parable was. Basically, we need an audience because otherwise there's no real community. There's no real point. So we hope you guys keep sharing, keep spreading the word. You can, you know, share our Facebook posts. You can retweet our tweets. You can just tweet at us and let us know that you're listening and what you want to hear so we can keep finding the best content and best people to talk with. We're going to come back next week with another episode. It's going to be awesome, as always. So I'm Arjun.
I'm Akash.
We'll catch you next week.
God bless.